you check with IT and get us a little card so that they can get on the internet? Thank you.
Please and thank you.
You're welcome.
And I hope it makes progress.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, good. To be honest, I wasn't super excited about that.
Hi, this is Judd Choate from the Secretary of State's office. We are convening the September 13th BIAC Commission meeting. Thank you all for joining us, commissioners, and those in the audience. We really appreciate your interest and attendance. We have a couple of pretty major items on the agenda we want to take care of in the next couple of hours. The first thing I thought we would do, though, since we have a couple of new members and some new people in the room, is that we might take this opportunity to reintroduce ourselves. This is only the second meeting of BIAC, so we're all sort of getting familiar with one another. The secretary is joining us by phone, and so I'll hand it off to him to make some introductory remarks if he so chooses and to introduce himself.
Swain Williams, I apologize for not being there in person. I have couple health issues going on. I appreciate everyone's interest and willingness to participate as we try to work together to help inform legislation and also inform the voters. And thank you for your being there. And my role this time is going to be kind of silent since I am remote, but I do very much appreciate your participation. And I apologize for not being there in person.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So I'm going to start to my left with Deputy Steyert.
Suzanne Steyert, I'm the Deputy Secretary of State.
Karen Goldman for the Colorado Municipal League.
Matt Crane, County Clerk's Association President and Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder.
Judd Choate, the State Election Director from the Secretary of State's office.
Dan Pabon, State Representative, House District 4.
Deborah Johnson, Denver Clerk and Recorder.
Jennifer Levin, Disability Law, Colorado.
Pam Bacon, Logan County Clerk and Recorder.
Elena Nunez, Common Cause.
Mike Weissman on behalf of Martha Tierney.
Michael Valdez, the Special District Association.
Patrick Neville, State Representative.
Dominic Moreno, State Representative of Commerce City and South Adams County.
Thank you very much. We appreciate all of you coming. So the way that the meeting will work is that we have various topics on our agenda. There is an opportunity for public testimony And that comes toward the end of the meeting. So please identify the topics that you want to speak about as we go through, and feel free to have a short comment toward the end of the meeting. The first thing we wanted to cover, which we didn't cover in the last meeting, was there is a reimbursement policy that the Secretary of State's office has for meetings here at the main office, and that is that if you're traveling within 35 miles, you can seek reimbursement, or outside of 35 miles, you can seek reimbursement for your travel costs if you meet certain criteria. Steve Ward tends to handle that, and so we are we want to kind of play deference to him. So if you're in that situation where you may be able to seek reimbursement, please let me know, and I'll get you in touch with Steve so that he can talk to you about what those parameters are.
Judge Senator yeah. Hulbert's joined.
Oh, yes. Ms. Senator, thanks for joining. The next topic, we had a question in the last meeting, which asked about our score list maintenance policies. So we've asked Ben Schler from our office to come and speak on those, and he has a handout for us.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Ben Schler. I'm the legal and policy manager in the elections division here at the Secretary of State's office. Does everybody have the handout? It's entitled Colorado's Voter Registration List Maintenance Activities. And for anybody in the audience that doesn't have one, there are some back here in the corner if you need to grab one. As the title indicates, this is the boring part of the day-to-day, I think. But the question was really, what does the Secretary of State's office do, and what do Colorado's counties do in order to essentially maintain accurate and clean voter rolls here in Colorado? This handout is kind of just a little bit of a brief explanation of a few of the things that we do. It includes footnotes at the bottom of the citations of the federal and state law that guide us in these procedures. But I just wanted to go through a few of the things that we do and answer any other questions that you have. So we'll just get started at the top of this handout. We are guided, and the counties are guided, by the National Voter Registration Act, the NVRA, when it comes to list maintenance. And so by that, I mean there are very strict procedures that we and the counties have to follow when it comes to updating voters' registration records, canceling voters' registration records, and things like that. In Colorado and in all 50 states, a county is not allowed to cancel a voter's registration record unless the county has received written notice from that voter that voter needs their registration canceled, or unless they follow what I kind of like to call the NVRA clock or the NVRA process. And that's that the county has received information that a voter no longer lives at the address where they're currently registered. And then the county sends them notice and says, hey, we have received notice that you don't live at this place anymore. Could you please confirm that? And once, if the voter does not respond to that information or to that notice, then the county has to wait for two general election cycles before they can cancel that voter. So that's kind of the time frame that a county follows before actually canceling a voter when the voter hasn't given them some sort of information themselves in order to take them off the rolls. But there are other ways that the county can cancel a voter, the main ones being for either death or felony conviction. And so in Colorado, we go through a monthly process for both of those in order to make sure that we cancel voters who should not be on the rolls because they've either died or because they've been convicted of a felony and are serving a sentence of incarceration or parole. The way that the counties make sure that they're properly canceling folks is they use what we call minimum matching criteria, which I've listed here. And basically what it is that you have to match the voter's name and date of birth, and then any one of either Colorado driver's license number, last four digits of the Social Security number or the residence address that's in their voter registration record. So even if you get what looks like a potential match, unless you've been able to establish all of those criteria, you're not able as a county to cancel that voter. The specific process that we go through or that the counties really go through when it comes to canceling voters due to death is based on two lists. The first list comes from the Colorado Department of Health and Health and Environment, and they send us a list once a month. And it's basically these are the folks that state agency has found have died. They send us that list. We import that into the statewide voter registration database that you all know as SCORE, and then that goes out to the counties. The counties are the ones who do the cancellation in the first place. They're the ones who maintain their own rolls. So the counties look at each one of those records that have been marked as someone who has died within their county. They make sure that they've met that minimum matching criteria, and if they do, then the county cancels that record and marks that person as deceased. The other list that we use, something that we've been using for not as long a time, but is a very good resource for us, is the Social Security Death Index. That's just another list, but a more nationalized list that we receive also on a monthly basis. We filter that list out to on a county-by-county basis, send that out to the counties through SCORE, and they follow that same minimum matching criteria process. And then convicted felons, that's a similar process, but through the Colorado Department of Corrections. They send us a monthly list. We populate that list into SCORE. The counties look for that minimum matching criteria, and then they cancel folks if that person is, according to the Department of Corrections, serving a sentence of incarceration for a felony conviction or they're on parole for a felony conviction. We also receive information from Colorado's U.S. Attorney's Office on a quarterly basis, and it's essentially the same process, and we get that information to the counties, and they do their cancellation. So that's kind of the universe of processes that our counties follow in order to cancel voters. The other thing that we do in Colorado in a couple of ways is we work to make sure that a voter's address, their residence address and their mailing address are up to date within the voter registration system, even if we don't get, you know, a specific written piece of information from the voter. And we do that in two different ways. The first is that we are able to use the National Change of Address Database, so NCOA. So when you go to the post office and you say, okay, I've moved, you fill out that form, and you let the post office know, they put that into their database, and then they share that database with us, and we filter it out to make sure that we're finding folks who are actually in the voter registration database. We then split it up by county, and we send it out to the counties, and then they do the work to actually update voters' information. So what counties are able to do since recent legislation passed in 2016 is if you have moved within your county or if you have moved anywhere else in the state of Colorado and the county gets notice of that through the NCOA, you're then able to update that voter's address and information and you send them notice, but you don't have to wait for them to respond to you or anything like that before you update the information. So it's essentially a process of making sure that you have the most up-to-date information from that voter, and that's based on the National Change of Address. The second component is through our work with the Colorado Department of Revenue, which is responsible for issuing driver's licenses. So under the federal law, when you go into a driver's license office, you're required to be asked whether or not you want to register to vote. And the Department of Revenue, we work closely with them to make sure that they do that. The other thing that we make sure that they do is let folks know that they're also going to be using the information they provide in order to update addresses. So it's not just for folks who have not yet registered. It's also for folks who are registered but who are updating their address information. Your driver's license is going to be one of the very first things that you update very often when you move, which is why the Department of Revenue is such a good resource for us when it comes to address change. We worked on a bill that passed in 2015, Senate Bill 60, that allowed us to have a little bit more of an exchange of information between our office and the Department of Revenue to make sure that not only are we getting those folks who are registering for the first time, but that we're also getting the folks who are changing their addresses and that that's coming into our system. It's a nightly upload, essentially. We get it every single day. Any transaction that happened between an applicant for a driver's license, someone who's getting a new driver's license, or someone who's simply changing their address. All of that information comes into our system, and we filter that out to the counties as well, and then they register those folks or update their address information as they see fit. So that's basically the kind of all of the different things that we do kind of to proactively maintain voter registration lists. Obviously, the counties are also in constant contact with their voters, and the voters are able to go online and update their addresses, go online and register, come into the county, you know, send in paper registration forms. But now that we're able to work with the Department of Revenue and use the National Change of Address database, it's much easier for counties to be able to update folks' voter registration when that might not be the address that they're thinking they need to change themselves when they move. And so it's been pretty good process. We continue to work to improve it, particularly in the realm of when you're at the driver's license office. For a long time, the way that the process worked at the driver's license office was you would come in, you're there to get your driver's license, and it was kind of a secondary question, oh, by the way, do you want to register to vote? And so a lot of people said no because they didn't really want to spend that extra time that they thought it would take during that transaction in order to also register to vote if they weren't registered or to even update their address information. We've been working really closely with the Department of Revenue and the counties as well to formulate a little bit better process. And as most of you know, the Department of Revenue is moving to a brand new driver's license system. That'll be rolling out in February of 2017. It's called Drives. It's a pretty great program compared to the antiquated, you know, technology that they're currently using. And we're looking to, you know, really leverage that to make sure that we get people registered and that it doesn't take extra time. And one of the biggest ways to do that has been to reformulate the question. So in 2017, when Drives rolls out, the new question is no longer going to be, oh, and do you also want to register to vote? It's simply going to be, we will be using the information you provide here today to register to you to vote unless you choose not to. And by the time you get to that affirmative statement in the process, the potential voter or applicant has already given you basically all the information that you need in order to register that person to vote, so it doesn't take any extra time. The affirmation that they have to sign that says, you know, yes, I'm a citizen and all those things, they're fully integrated into the new signature pad that the Department of Revenue is using. And so we really think that this is going to help us get folks registered who may have in the past under the old process said, I don't want to spend that extra time to register to vote. And since so many people go to the driver's license office, it's a great place to do it. And one of the other benefits of it, you know, a lot of you have seen in states like Oregon and the like that have passed what they call automatic voter registration, which is where when folks go into the driver's license office, they become registered, but there is no actual, back and forth between the person at the Department of Revenue or the driver's license office and the applicant about voter registration. It's more of a, we intake the information, then we send you out a card later that says, you know, yes, we've registered you to vote, and what's your party affiliation? You know, you don't get to have that immediate back and forth interaction in order to make sure that you get all the information. I'm sorry, do you have a question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Seems that the premise of the conversation at the driver's license office has been, and it sounds like it may continue to be wrong, and that is not, would you like to register to vote? But the first question in my mind ought to be, are you currently registered to vote? Because we have this ongoing problem with people whose names change for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And they're asked, would you like to register to vote? And they say yes, and they end up being registered twice. And having sponsored the bill to help deal with people who end up with more than one voter ID for whatever reason, I am grateful for that legislation being in place. But it seems as though that at the driver's license office, the first question ought to be, are you currently registered? And if so, would you like to update that registration rather than would you like to register to vote? Because in the mind of the, I think, the average citizen voter, that distinction is probably not clear, and they say, sure.
Right.
So will the new system address that in any way, that looking at, oh, you are currently registered, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and would you like to update an address or party affiliation or whatever? But is there anything in the new system that will help guide it toward updating what already exists rather than duplicating that?
It is. It won't go down the path that you were talking about as far as the question of are you already registered to vote. And the reason for that is a lot of folks don't even know if they're registered to vote or not. But what we do in order to take care of the issue that you're talking about, which is you don't want to have someone registered twice. First of all, at the driver's license office, they're going to ask the necessary questions at the front end that establish things like, did you change your name, and things like that. But when the county gets that information, it comes in electronically into what we call the registration module for driver's licenses in the SCORE database. They're going to be looking at the date of birth, the driver's license number, the address, basically those minimum matching criteria components that I talked about when we were talking about canceling. And they're going to see, and it automatically will pop up for them and say, this person is already registered to vote. So while we don't ask them the question, are you already registered to vote? We know once it gets to the county that they are already registered to vote.
Thank you. The other question I have is on using the minimum matching criteria and purging, and the NCOA is great, driver's license, but is that from those points in time moving forward relative to the registration list, or is there a way to go back and run those kinds of reports on the registration list back in time? Having worked a lot of get out the vote effort, I understand the process of purging voters two election cycles after a piece of mail comes back undeliverable. But I also, just in the last primary season, talked with people who bought a house 8-10 years ago and are frustrated that people are still coming to the door asking for the prior homeowner. So I don't suspect that those ballots are being voted. I just know that there's data that's out of date. And is there a way to go back and purge out, either at the county level or at the state level, purge out information or run it against the NCOA to say, oh, wait, this family moved 8-10 years ago?
I think the answer to that is that it would be difficult to use those particular databases because they really are kind of more of a real-time type of thing, and there's not a lot of historical data that would be accurate at this point to use that. One of the things that I think will address the issue that you've seen, you know, when you're walking and you talk to folks who say, you know, this person's ballot is still coming, number one, I do think that that's still pretty rare, and particularly now that we, let's see, just so I remember the bill number here, House Bill 1093, which was one that allowed allow the counties to use NCOA even more, in that they could update folks not just who moved within the county, but folks who move anywhere in the state. The other thing that it did was it fixed a couple of, for lack of a better word, glitches that were still in Title I regarding definitions of the type of notices that go out. And basically what it did was it made sure that we were putting people on what I was call the NVRA clock and that canceling the voter clock. Because like you said, you've got people who say it's been 10 years, right? And a big reason for that, for folks kind of not making it into that NVRA cancellation world, was that we had poor definitions for what it meant to, or for what the county could use as a type of bounced back piece of mail from the post office. And so because we fixed those definitions, it's going to be a much smoother and easier process for folks to get on that clock. And so anything that bounces back at this point, the county is going to be able to make that person inactive, meaning that they're not going to receive a ballot. It's going to put them on that clock. And there's going to be some folks who, through the legacy process, who had been sitting out there for a long time, they're going to fall off the list eventually. And I think that because we cleaned up those definitions, that issue is going to go away. And I think we'll see a big chunk of that after the 2016 general election, and we'll see a big chunk of that after the 2018 general election.
You might, for any speakers on our crew, just go ahead and identify yourself so that people online can know who.
Dominic Moreno. Ben, can you give me an idea, going along the lines of your partnership with the Department of Revenue, what that process looks like for pre-registration? Because I imagine a lot of the information from those young folks are coming through the DMV offices.
So I actually think that because, Judd, do you want to field that one? I actually am not sure about the pre-registration.
So the pre-registration, the only current avenue that we really make pre-registration available is through online voter registration. The people at the DMV are not supposed to be asking 16 and 17 year olds, would you like to register to vote? They could. And they can use those forms to register to vote, but that's not part of their MVRA requirements. They can go online and register to vote as 16 and 17 year olds, and that would make them pre-registrants in our database.
Hey, Judd.
Yes, Wayne.
Can you talk about what we're doing with high school registration, the event we've got coming up, and then also talk about list maintenance with Eric and the Kansas Project?
Yes, so the upcoming event that the secretary references is at Yuma High School in the afternoon. I believe it's 3 o'clock on September 23rd. That event is to highlight a particular program that we've begun with an organization called Inspire Colorado. And Inspire Colorado is a nonprofit, and it's actually Inspire USA, and they have branches in many different U.S. states. And they have started a program with our office to create an award for those high schools which get 85% of their senior class registered to vote. And the Eliza Rout Award is the plaque that we give out to those high schools which successfully meet that level. And the first recipient will be Yuma High School. So they're the first high school in the state that entered this program and successfully got to 85%. It will also, the next high school that met that criteria was Eagle Crest. And their event is the week following. So on September 30th, there's an event at their high school to also celebrate their success. I will tell you that the Yuma High School event is quite a big thing. We anticipate at this point that Senator Gardner will be there, Representative Sonnenberg, and we're hoping Senator Becker will both be in attendance. Bev Wenger, who is the county clerk for Yuma County, as well as county commissioners and the sheriff. So it'll be a big event to celebrate this sort of first in the state event. So the Eagle Crest one is a somewhat smaller event because we're sort of tucking it into an already existing assembly, so we have far less time to do a big celebration at that. But we do thank them for their 5 minutes. So But this is hopefully part of a larger effort to have a yearly celebration of those high schools that meet this criteria, and to try to branch all the way across the state to reach all the high schools who are eligible. The second question the secretary suggested that we discuss was ERIC. So the Electronic Registration Information Center, which everyone calls ERIC, is a national consortium of states. Right now it's 21 states and the District of Columbia, so 22 jurisdictions around the country have all joined together to provide a copy of their voter registration list and also a copy of their DMV list. And ERIC is run out of an office in Oregon, and that at that office what they do is they have this very sophisticated algorithm which allows it to marry up these lists to identify people who are currently in your DMV file, who you can or update, or can provide information to the voter to allow them to update their records. And then it also can identify people who have moved within the 22 jurisdictions. So you may have lost a voter from Colorado and it has gone to Oregon, and ERIC can figure out that this same person has disappeared from one jurisdiction and entered another jurisdiction, and it allows us as a state to reach out to those voters and say, hey, it looks like you don't live here anymore. We'd really like for you to cancel your record so that we don't end up in that two-cycle MVRA cancellation period, and instead we can get them canceled off of the rolls right away. So that's a big function of ERIC. It also includes, Ben mentioned that we use both the CDPHE list, which is the death list from people who die within the state of Colorado or are receiving benefits in the state of Colorado. It also, ERIC includes the SSI, which is the Social Security Index, which is the national death list of those who are receiving national benefits or in some way show up on the SSI list. Neither one of those are perfect lists, so there are people that sort of fall between the cracks, but having those two sort of Venn diagrams overlapping on one another, we're capturing a whole bunch of those people who die either within or outside the state of Colorado and are potentially cancelable under federal law. Mr. Secretary, was there anything else you want us to cover on that topic?
Just talk a little bit about the Kansas Project as well and what that involves.
Yes.
And I think these are important for what we're doing to go above and beyond the requirements to try to make our list as good as we possibly can make them. And I think some of these address some of the issues Senator Holbert asked about, you know, as we do these cross-checks with other counties or with other states, and then we're also actively working to try to bring the other jurisdictions into ERIC so it becomes a more robust process.
Yes, absolutely. So the Kansas Project, as it's known, is also a list exchange, and that includes around 30 states in the country. And what that is that after each major election, so after each even year general election, the state of Kansas coordinates with the state of Arkansas to acquire all of the voter lists from all the participating states. And then they compare who voted across those various states, and they identify people who have moved to a different state. So some states use that for list maintenance. That's not the way we use the list, and frankly, it's not the way the majority of the states use the list. The way the majority of the states use that list is to identify people who look like they have voted in multiple jurisdictions. So, for instance, after the 2010 election, and then again in the 2012 election, we identified several people who had voted in Arizona and Kansas who also had voted in Colorado. And FBI agents were sent to their door and explained to them that that's a violation of federal law. And that if anything like that ever happened again, they would be prosecuted for voter fraud. So that was the way in which we've used that list to try to identify double voters. It is in a way a list maintenance, but not in the truest sense a list maintenance. We believe that after this election, the ERIC list, through this algorithm that the states exchange, will also start doing vote history, which will allow it to be to identify voters across state lines as well. And we feel really good about what ERIC can produce along those lines to identify double voters. So that's definitely something we're doing to try to protect against voter fraud.
Judd, I have a question. Yes, what was the name of the high school program?
The high school program is from Inspire Colorado. And I can get you, in fact, I'll circulate to this group the contact information for the Inspire Colorado guys who have done a fantastic job of reaching out to various high schools. In fact, the two that have won this award are just two of the many that they have already begun working with. The hope is to get several high schools sort of over the 85% bar before this election, for obvious reasons, to try to get people enthusiastic about voting in the upcoming election. Were there other questions? Elena.
So
I actually have a few questions now. Going back to pre-reg, is it correct, did I understand you correctly, if a 16-year-old goes into the motor vehicles office, they're not offered the opportunity to register, that only happens through other mechanisms?
That is my understanding. I think that the DMV has read the MVRA to only apply to the 18-year-old plus. We can certainly talk to them about that, but at this point, that's the way that they interpret their obligation under the MVRA.
Okay, great. Then my other question, I didn't quite understand. When someone goes into motor vehicles and updates their address, do they have to answer yes to the question about using it for voter registration purposes, or is it now because of Senate Bill 60 and other improvements between the two departments, does that information automatically update the voter record so that there's not that disconnect between the driver license and the voter registration?
It is an automatic update, but the NVRA does require the option for the person to opt out. So it's not that they have to say yes, it's that if they don't want it to happen, then they can say, I don't want you to use this information. But it is a seamless transfer of information. So as long as that person doesn't opt out, the fact that they've updated their address is going to make it to the county, and the county is going to then update that information.
So is this
and just to clarify that's with the new drive system? So
it
so
is.
That will
so
be in June of next year.
So February of next year, it'll become a fully seamless process where it's an opt out as opposed to them answering yes, I want this information to be used.
Right. So then in the process, as the voter is going through the transaction, at some point the question, instead of being, would you like this to be used, it's, great, we're going to update your voter record unless you don't want us to. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, great. And then
I would just add that at that point, if the person says, no, I don't want to opt out, then they're put through the battery of questions related to their voter registration. So then they're invited to, do you want to register with a party? And so they do all of the things which in the automatic registration states then happen remotely, happen with a postcard that happens, you know, some weeks after that original transaction.
So then the opt-out is also for voter registration, not just for updates?
Yes. So basically I won't be able to remember the phrase exactly, but it's something to the tune of, we will use the information you've provided for voter registration purposes unless you decline. And so it's whether you're not registered, whether you are registered, we're going to use that information to update your information
okay.
in the voter registration record.
Okay. Then I guess my last question, going back to how Department of Corrections information is used, I understand that monthly the rolls are run against the file. What happens when someone goes off parole, so they're then eligible to be re-registered? Is it simply that they're no longer on the list, so if they re-register, their record no longer gets flagged, or is there somehow an update that shows that their record is no longer ineligible?
No, it's essentially it's incumbent upon them to re-register, and then the fact that they're not on the list is I guess the check on the other side for the county. But it is incumbent upon that person who has finished serving their sentence or parole to essentially re-register.
So it's not like there's a list of people who are no longer ineligible to register that then gets uploaded. It's sort of the reverse.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Patrick Neville here. I'm just trying to think back of when I was 18. Isn't it correct that when you turn 18, you have to come in to get a new driver's license anyway? So we see those people come through the DMV regardless once they turn 18?
Yes.
Other questions? Yes, Jennifer.
This is Jennifer from Disability Law Colorado. I was just wondering, so you know the other state agencies that provide public assistance for people that are also required to offer registration under NBRA. I was wondering if you capture that information the same way you do through DMV.
Sure. We don't. We do work closely with those agencies to make sure that they're offering applicants the opportunity to register to vote. But that is currently a paper process. And the biggest reason for that is that you have several state agencies, you even have federal agencies, and there is no one unified database the way that there is, you know, like with Motor Voter. That said, I do know that there are, there are folks talking about trying to make that more of a seamless process. There is the Colorado Benefits Management System, which does kind of pull in a lot of those different agencies. And, you know, eventually there may be a way to leverage that system in order to make it more of a seamless, you know, electronic transfer. We're definitely not there yet, and that's going to take a lot of work. It's been a 2-year process to get where we are with the Department of Revenue with their new system, and I think that it's worthwhile working toward that with the agencies, but we're definitely not there yet. So right now it's simply a paper process.
Other questions for Ben? All right. Well, thank you, Ben. We appreciate it. The next topic on our agenda was Trevor Timmons is going to talk to us about score security. At the last meeting, there was a question about that, and there were other score-related questions. So, Trevor, take it away.
Thank you, Jed. My name is Trevor Timmons. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Secretary of State's office. Many of you have probably seen some of the media attention around the security of elections systems generally. Obviously, we've been paying close attention to that conversation. I believe it actually broke into the media when an FBI flash report was released to a news outlet. Our office, as well as I would imagine most elections offices across the country, actually had access to that report several weeks prior to that FBI report. The FBI report did provide some additional information in terms of one additional IP address that may have been involved in some attacks on two different states. And so we took appropriate actions with regards to that extra computer that had been seen. But we actually knew about that early on. In fact, at the clerk's conference in early August, I served on a panel speaking to the clerks on elections issues, and I mentioned to the clerks that this at that point, it wasn't an FBI report. It was a report from an organization, the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, that they had provided the initial report of this elections, reconnaissance activity that had been seen against two different State Board of Elections websites. And we provided that information to the clerks at that forum because under the rules under which the MSISAC releases information, they do allow recipients of that information, based on the depth of information contained within their alerts, they do allow dissemination of that information to folks that work in that industry. And so we did provide some notice to the counties at the conference that we'd seen that sort of activity. We followed up with counties subsequently in a weekly newsletter that we provide. We reiterated the controls that are in place in terms of user acceptance policies, in terms of county management of secure systems to be used in the voting process, both voter registration as well as voting equipment. And then since that time, of course, we've had several opportunities to relay that again with increased emphasis. Obviously, there's been a lot of attention within the media on the security of election systems. I saw during the 9/11 celebrations on Sunday morning, I saw the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, on television also reiterating the amount of concern and the monitoring that's in place to respond to those elections security incidents that have been seen. In terms of Colorado, several steps that we took are that when we received that initial MSISAC notice, we actually scanned our logs to see if we'd seen network activity from those specific sources. We had not. We also took a look at our logs to see if we'd seen those same kinds of attacks against the SCORE system, our state voter registration system. We had not. We also put blocks in place so that the computers that were the sources of those attacks cannot actually reach state assets. We've also reached out to the State Division of Homeland Security and established that, reinforced that relationship with them in terms of the monitoring and the reconnaissance that they're able to keep their eyes open to. We've reached out to the Federal Department of Homeland Security. We've reached out to several counties that have strength in this area of cybersecurity. City and County of Denver, specifically, we're working with them to stand up what is called in the cybersecurity arena, it's called a fusion center. It's called a fusion center because they fuse information from a variety of sources to actually provide that real-time monitoring and awareness in terms of monitoring and response if some activity is seen, and make that available on a broad basis to those folks who actually have the capability and the resources to be able to do something about any attacks or any activity that appears to be not run-of-the-mill kind of elections activity. We've also worked with the state's chief information security officer and the governor's office of information technology to make sure that we're well aware, and we've got contact numbers for folks at the Front Range Gigapop, at CenturyLink, at Level 3, within the governor's office of IT, so that if we detect some activity, that we can actually reach out to the right people and make sure that we're taking the appropriate steps, again, to make sure that the state voter registration database is well protected. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Trevor, for those who are listening, can you just clarify the difference between the registration system and the tabulation?
Absolutely. This was actually a subject that came up during a conference call that was held between members of the National Association of Secretaries of State, folks from the Federal Department of Homeland Security, folks from the Department of Justice, folks from NIST, and folks from the Federal Election Assistance Commission. There are really two distinct elements to the election system, at least in Colorado. There's a voter registration system, which really keeps track of eligibility, keeps track of the ballot style that will be available to a voter, and supports, same-day registration up to and on, including election day, and then tracking of ballots, mail ballots as they're returned. And then, downstream from that is actually the tabulation system, the voting system upon which a ballot is marked, a ballot is tabulated. The results of the votes are actually collected and then accumulated and then provided. We support the posting of those via an election night reporting system. Counties obviously maintain those tabulated results in their systems, and then they move through the Canvas process for official certification. So they're really two separate parts, and there really is a divide between the two. On the tabulation side, those systems are air gap separated from internet. They're not connected to internet. That's absolutely true in Colorado. I believe that's true in every state in the country. There's obviously great sensitivity around the manipulation of election results, the potential for that, and so you know, election officials at the local and the state level obviously take take steps to prevent any sort of manipulation from occurring.
This is Elena Nunez. To follow up a little bit, and if I'm jumping ahead, it's fine to wait, but one of the things that came up at the COVAIM Commission quite a bit was the conversation around making sure that WebScore was fully functional and reliable at all of the VSPCs. And as you're talking about security, it seems like that would be a vulnerability if there are outages, whether they're malicious or otherwise. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that sort of planning goes into this conversation, and then also what sort of contingency plans are in place if there were some sort of wide-scale attack, either at the service center level on connectivity or higher up the chain.
Absolutely. Thank you. Again, this is Trevor Timmons. So obviously the last-ditch defense on election day is a provisional ballot. Every individual that walks in to vote, if their eligibility cannot be determined, then a provisional ballot application, you know, that is the last-ditch line of defense. That assumes that there's no network connectivity to an individual voter service and polling center. Prior to that, you know, obviously we want to make sure that the system is available so real-time that access can be determined. You know, to make sure that that individual is properly registered to vote, that they haven't returned a ballot in some other location, and to make sure that we've got full information to issue them a regular ballot. And obviously that's the normal course of operations. We've done significant load testing on both our online voter lookup as well as voter service and polling centers, as well as the back office activities, receipt of mail ballots that are received by counties. To give you an idea of some of the testing that we've done, we have, as part of the load test of WebScore that we conducted, we actually took all the activity, you know, the volume of activity that we saw in the 2014 gubernatorial election over the, you know, little over 2 weeks that were available for folks to actually walk in and register and then cast a ballot. We took that activity and we actually compressed it over a four-hour period. So there were around 105,000 voter transactions during the early voting and on election day during that about 15-day period. We actually replicated over 200,000 transactions over a four-hour period just to verify that we were able to sustain that sort of load. We also do testing on that online voter registration system where folks can, they can register to vote, they can update their information, they can also check to see that their ballot is actually, their mail ballot has actually been returned. The last series of tests that we did spanned the course of a couple of hours at 10 transactions per second, which is a much higher load than we saw during the primary election, and we saw a sustained load 2 hours. We actually saw no errors with a reasonable response time. That was not the case during the presidential caucus earlier this year in March. During that time, we identified some memory leaks that prevented that online voter lookup from actually performing well. So we did some analysis on that. We did some code analysis, made some changes, and have actually deployed that even before the primary to make sure that we could actually support that load, support that Elections Day activity.
Thanks. And I guess as a follow-up, maybe this is a question for the counties. How, what does the planning look like in terms of provisional ballots at VSPCs? Because, you know, one of the benefits of the models is that we can really move away from provisional ballots, but if there were a catastrophic outage, the way that every voter gets to vote is the provisional. So how is that part of the planning process?
Hi, this is Matt Crane. I think most counties are planning, if not all counties, are planning to have an extra stock of provisional ballots as the main contingency plan. I think it's the only real contingency plan that we have. So counties are counting on that.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
Thank you. That works. I'm Peg Cage. I am representing the Colorado State GOP as Steve House's surrogate. I'm also the chairman of Boulder County Republicans, and as you've talked with Al Kolwitz, who represents the Colorado Voter Group, he has put together a 40-some page report about problems with the data between the VR-011 and CE-068. And I know you talked with him, but I don't know that everybody else knows that. Do you mind if I just read part of his report to you? Just the live VR-011 transactions during that occurred during the entire election period do in fact compromise the quality of the CE-068 data. Just to be clear, the CE, the voter registration is the VR-011, and then the CE-068 is the ballots that have been sent, correct? Okay. So they don't jive. There exists no mechanism or hand adjustment process in place to synchronize or adjust to make the two files coherent. CE-068 does not provide the data needed to confirm that every ballot placed into the custody of election officials does in fact get accepted for counting or rejected for cause. And as I said, he's got this whole chart, pages and pages and pages of chart where they don't jive. And actually, in a primary election, it's supposed to be all Democrats and Republicans, but we've got Green Party members and unaffiliated on this CE-068 list, which means that they were sent a ballot, correct?
Again, this is Trevor. Means they received a ballot.
They received a ballot. So they apparently turned it in to the secretary or to the clerk, and it was recorded.
Again, this is Trevor. So individuals can change their party affiliation during a primary and choose to vote in that election.
Right.
And that is the
source
of... So
if they were registered, we've got they were registered as Democrat or Republican, but the ballot, the CE-068... says unaffiliated or green.
Is there a question?
Yeah, there's a question. Why? How? What is a green party ballot in a Democrat and Republican primary election?
So again, this is Trevor Timmons. So the sources, and I know there are more than four sources that Mr. Kollwitz used for his report.
Right.
They cover the span of election activity from the establishment of a primary when ballots are mailed out to Republicans and Democrats that are affiliated with the party at that time, all the way through Election Day. And then he's also referring to sources that are part of the canvass process, which is after Election Day. And the fact that people can change their party affiliation or they can move and walk in and update their registration, or they could move out of Boulder County and walk into another county and update their registration. They all contribute to the fact that the voter registration information 60 days, 30 days, 2 days before primary election day cannot be reconciled to canvass reports on ballots that are returned and counted, you know, during the course of the election. I mean, it's an extremely dynamic system. And without reports that are generated to the second of every aspect of the process, it's very, very difficult to actually dispositively account for every individual and the ballot they were issued and the status of it having been returned.
Isn't that a problem where we're counting on the data?
Trevor, would that report, because like, this is Pam Bacon, sorry, isn't Pickin home-ruled? And so they have, because when we were looking at the reports that we receive, I questioned the fact that why is there different parties? And would that report have that same information on there from like Pickin that's home-ruled? Or no? That they may be looking at?
Again, this is Trevor. So I think that the report from Mr. Kollwitz covered mostly voters and ballot status in Boulder County. If there are voters who moved into or out of Pitkin County while Boulder County was conducting their election, then that could be reflected in the information.
Another feature of that sort of continually dynamic database is that a person can be in one party, they can switch to another party, they can receive a ballot, they can vote that ballot, and then they can switch back to their other party. And so often if you're taking a snapshot in time of the database, you may catch them at a time in which they're not in the party in which of the ballot in which they voted.
And that's one of the problems with trying to reconcile these various lists. The EX68 is not supposed to be reconciled against the VR1 because the VR1 is the ongoing voter registration information. The 68 is about what ballots come back in. Those two things can't be married up.
Well, there can't be a green ballot in a primary election. Well, just to say something that is a little off topic, but it's directly on topic. I think that we are getting mired down into a lot of muck about data and what the clerks and the officials are to do about it. And we're forgetting that this is a primary election where people have gone to their caucuses and they have sent officials up to the next level and the next level, and they have selected candidates to be on the ballot. And this is for the parties to choose who will represent them in government. This is not for you guys to be able to play with numbers and big machines and stuff like that. This, we are supposed to be representing the voters and making sure that they are able to have their voice heard and that each party is able to choose the best representative. I think that when we make it too easy to vote and include all this, you know, watch this hand over here magic type of stuff, that distracts us. We forget that we are supposed to be choosing our representatives, and it is not fair for us to take money from the entire population and spend it on all of these things and distract everybody when the purpose is for them to select their representation. I don't think that the state ought to be involved in primary elections.
Were there any other questions for Trevor? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, did you want to make any comments here? We're leaving the conversations about list maintenance and score security, and we're going to start a conversation about the presidential primary.
Yeah, let me just add that we do take the security issues carefully, and we respect security. We work very hard to ensure that the systems are as robust as possible, and the breaches that have occurred in a couple states, we have taken every reasonable step to ensure those do not occur here. The registration system is something that is important. It does have personal identifiable information in it, but it's important to note that a breach of a registration system does not affect a tabulation system. As Trevor pointed out, those are not connected to the Internet. Those exist in locked, secured rooms with video surveillance that, in addition, the machines themselves have tamper-evident seals, so there are a whole host of security precautions we've taken because we do take that very seriously in Colorado, and I just wanted folks to be aware of that as you see various reports and information. So that was what I wanted to add. Thanks, Jed.
All right. The next item on our agenda was to discuss the presidential primary initiative. Mr. Secretary, would you like to make some introductory remarks for this?
As you're probably aware, both of the potential election issues were certified to the ballot. They had signatures for that process. I guess there's three election issues. One of them changes future initiative standards for the Constitution, and then two deal with a way of selecting candidates. And so that information is certainly charged with are fixing issues in the ballot issues, and one of the questions would be, how much do we want to talk about those in advance of the ballot issue so that people are aware these are the problems with it, this is where some changes would need to be made. So I throw that out to PAC for discussion, and I will listen to what's discussed.
So, and I just to sort of summarize what the Secretary is saying, I think one of our objectives here is to try to better understand how number 140 would play out in the presidential primary in a future election. And if there are areas of 140 that might require some changes if it were to pass. So that's sort of where the discussion is. Does anyone want to volunteer some opening thoughts? Yes.
This is Dan Pabone. You know, I think we've all had a chance to look at 140 and seen its intent, but we know that changing the rules of the election system is can be cumbersome and is a very delicate approach because we're essentially dealing with the enfranchisement of our citizens. And so I think it's incumbent upon us, if we have found some either technical issues or legal issues that will need to be addressed, whether this if this ballot initiative passes, I think we need to identify those issues at the front end, flag them for ourselves and the public, and be prepared to address them should this initiative pass. And the reason I think that's important is because this is a citizen initiative, and of course we want to keep the intent of the voters and what they are trying to accomplish, but at the same time I think there's going to be a scalpel approach that's going to be needed to remedy some of these flaws, and so I think as part of the record we should make that clear.
Other comments? Peg?
Peg Cage Boulder again. The ballot initiatives and the HB 1454 and SB 116 that were pushed at the end of the legislation system or term past year were all trying to solve a problem. And I listened to the last one of these board meetings, and there was a lot of talk about how do we get around the all-mail ballot voting. I think that rather than, well, let me tell you why I was late. Okay, I plugged into my GPS 1700 Broadway Street, and it took me to 1700 South Broadway. And then I got here and I parked and I realized when I was coming here that I didn't pay for parking, so I had to walk back and pay for parking. Okay, so twice I've had to adjust my destination and turn around and go in the right direction. I think that we have taken our destination from finding the intent of the voter and getting them the best representation for their party platform to let's figure out how to run an election that is basically screwy. I mean, you have an all-mail ballot election. There's no way to keep track of who gets a ballot, when they get a ballot, when they cast a ballot. The Secretary of State has gone so far as to redefine the term cast. Do you know that now when you cast your ballot, the definition is ballots cast is when the county clerk receives your ballot. So if you put it in the mailbox or you put it in a drop-off box, your ballot hasn't been cast yet. It's not cast until the county clerk receives that. I think we need to work on fixing these things if they get passed, but I think our legislation change that we should be thinking about making is not how to make a better presidential primary or more state primaries. It should be how do we get rid of all mail ballot voting and go back to even the punch cards made more sense than this. So thank you.
Other comments? Yeah, Jennifer.
This is Jennifer from Disability Law. I was just wondering if the primary election would be run like the general election under the same rules where you'd have to have an accessible voting machine and a VSPC.
I want to hand that off to a county clerk. Would you guys like to jump in? The answer is yes, but...
Yes. Short answer is yes.
That's what I wanted to hear.
So let me throw out a couple of ideas that I think might maybe jumpstart a conversation on ways in which this particular initiative could be changed slightly. If this were to pass, I think one big issue does sort of stand out, and that is that there are a number of facets to the initiative which would be somewhat different for a voter and may very well create some misunderstandings on the voter's part where they may accidentally create a ballot that can't be counted. There are other jurisdictions around the country that have primaries that are at least sort of close to what this initiative would be like. And I've talked to a couple of them, and they typically have what you might call a cure, a way for a voter to fix an error that they've made before that ballot is counted. So one thing that the initiative's language does not include right now is the ability to cure. And if we were to have this initiative pass, one of the things that the legislature might want to consider is ways to allow a voter to cure a ballot that can't be counted. So that's like one thing that I think should be on the table. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Elena?
This is Elena Nunez. I just have a question. How would that work in practice? Would it be that the voter would waive their right to the secret ballot so that the county could go back and say, we realized that there was a mistake? Or would the voter offer a preference on the front end so they weren't given the opportunity to make the mistake? Like, how could that look in terms of practice of solving those problems?
So I think it would have the second idea that you just posed was, I think, the way that you would have to address that. And that is that on the outside of the envelope, the voter would need to identify, I have voted for the Democrats or I have voted for the Republicans or potentially even another party. And then if they failed to answer one of those two or fill one of those two boxes, they have committed basically an unrecoverable error, which would require a cure. And then if they've checked both boxes, they've committed an error, which would require a cure. Hypothetically, if they have gone to the trouble of selecting what they have done on the outside of the envelope, hopefully they have kept to that once they've gotten inside to the ballot. But you would also have a problem which would not be curable of a person saying, I'm only voting the Republican side of the ballot, and then you see the ballot and you see that they've actually voted both sides or maybe the wrong side of the ballot. That's something that can't be cured, but those other errors can be cured. And in fact, in the Washington State data, the failure to mark the outside of the envelope properly or the failure to mark anything on the outside of the envelope accounted for over half of the curable issues. So, and quite a bit, a big percentage of those. So that I think is sort of one thing that this group could consider as possible legislative fix.
Peg Cage, I just have a question I don't see on here. Originally, I thought that the choice of the voters in this primary election was bound to that candidate that won the election, and that's been shown to be unconstitutional in a lawsuit already. Has that been removed from this ballot initiative?
That's not in the current language of the initiative, at least as I understand what you're saying. So, no, that's not a part of the initiative that will be on the ballot.
So you can go through the whole process of having a primary and choose a candidate for each party by state mass voting, and then when they go to the national convention, they're not bound to have to select that choice?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the person that the party selects, so the representative of the party at the convention. I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about the individual
voter. I'm talking about this ballot. Once you have the election and you come up with the winner for each of the parties, do the people who are selected at their assemblies, at their state assembly, do they have to go to the national convention and vote for the person that was elected in this primary election? Are they bound according to this? Because I don't see it here, but it was on the original.
This is Suzanne. They are, in the initiative language itself, they are bound. The thing that makes the initiative a little different than I think the cases that you're describing is that the initiative has an opt-out. And so if the political parties wish to not hold a primary that's under the Secretary of State and held in accordance with the terms of the initiative, the party can opt out by a 75% vote of their central committee, and then the primary would be held in whatever rules the party had established.
Thank you.
Are there other issues that
Dominic Moreno, just a question about fully recognizing that I'm not an election practitioner. From a process standpoint, I'm wondering why it's necessary to identify which party you voted for on the outside of an envelope versus some of the previous examples I've seen where you kind of fill it in on the ballot and then you vote accordingly for the party that you've selected. Why is that identification necessary outside the ballot?
Well, it's not necessary. It probably would reduce the number of errors because it would sort of force a person to understand when they're filling out their ballot or when they're filling out their envelope that they are only allowed to choose one side of the ballot in the current description of the initiative. But it's not necessary. It's the problems that occur inside the ballot are just not curable. Once you've opened the envelope and removed the ballot, you can't really cure anything at that point.
Jed, let me add one thing to that. If you're trying to reconcile a canvas and you're trying to figure out how many votes is the max that can be in the Republican primary, the Democratic primary, you have to know what the possible denominator is. And so the absence of that information would make the canvas challenging.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah, Patrick Neville here. Just another thing I think we would have to look at if this were to pass is the overall election calendar pertaining to this. I think it's quite a bit of effort for the clerks to run multiple elections. This could put them in a position where they're running three different elections, you know, if it's bounced right up to the municipal special districts, and it might even affect some of the special districts too, the fact that they might have to be turned away. I don't know if they could have the capacity to do that. So I think that's something we would need to look at.
Hi, this is Matt Crane. Couple of things. I'm not sure it matters where you put the checkbox for the preference, on the envelope or on the ballot itself. I think either place, I think we'll see a higher rate of ballots that are spoiled because of ballot error. I think from the Clerks Association standpoint, the one thing that we're most concerned about is this issue. Regardless, you know, if it's the will of the people that this passes, then we're really glad it's statutory, because the way that it's drawn up in this initiative, I think, is somewhat reckless and threatens, you know, the integrity and the outcome of our elections. There's better ways to do this. For example, if we get a preference from the voter before a ballot is mailed, all of the concerns over ballot spoilage go away. Republicans have to give a preference, right? We affiliate with a party, so do Democrats. So I think asking that of unaffiliated is not an undue burden to say before ballots are mailed, let us know how you want to vote. That takes care of the spoilage issue completely. Now, regarding the, and we're concerned about that for both initiatives, so that's not just for this one. Regarding this one, I think Representative Neville brings up a great point and something that we've talked about. When you look at, we talk about funding and our budgets are pushed to the edge right now. Everybody's strapped as much as they can be. So why would we set up a primary, a second primary within a 6-month period? I think the clerks generally support the idea of a presidential primary because we love the idea of ballot access and getting the most people involved in the process. But it seems to me the best way to do that would be to combine both primaries on the same ballot. I think that will help. I think that will help turnout, actually, if people are looking for one ballot and then they'll go and vote all the way up and down that ballot. But I think there are better solutions than what's represented in these initiatives. And so I'm glad that we can go back, as you've said, sir, to fix what's in there.
I agree that having some requirement to at least temporarily affiliate makes sense. It seems the process of voting in November, talked with people about the caucus process and assembly and the differences between a primary and a general. But in a general election, we all get, or all voters at the same address would get the same ballot. And there's no problem with voting cross-party. And having a ballot in a primary that prohibits cross-party seems like we're reinforcing two different standards. We're confusing that. Not that voters can't figure that out, but it does seem that the process would be contrary to what it is in November, and people who are accustomed to being able to vote one way in one election and a different way in another race on that same ballot, it seems unnecessarily confusing. And I just wonder if there is disagreement among the committee, the panel, about having some sort of affiliation or at least temporary declaration that I would like that ballot or that ballot, ballot A or ballot B, or R or D. is there disagreement that having all of the races and prohibiting cross-party voting, does anyone see that as not confusing?
This is Deborah Johnson, Denver clerk, and I agree with some of the issues you're bringing up, Senator Holbert. I think the ability to declare before an election is already there. Given that we have same-day registration, you can do that. You can go in and change your party affiliation and get your ballot right that day. I agree with you in the sense that it probably is very confusing that you would only have to do a straight ticket. I think I just saw in Michigan where, you know, they still have that system. You do a straight ticket. But Colorado, we're used to going back and forth. And I would fully support something of that nature, that someone could go back and forth on either party all the way down the ticket.
I guess I'm confused. You mean you would support people being able to cross over?
Yes.
Okay. And vote one race R and one race D, and that wouldn't disqualify the ballot?
In a primary.
In the primary, as long as you didn't do, you know, I didn't vote both candidates in both parties at the same thing. That's an overvote. But if I voted for a Democrat, say, senator, and then I voted a Republican congressperson, then.
Okay. And that's assuming we're talking about 98, not 140.
Right.
I mean, 140 is just the presidential.
Correct.
Okay. So you would say you don't have to pick a preference at all. You can just, you would advocate for a complete open primary system.
That's correct. I mean, isn't that the majority party now in the state, unaffiliated?
Well, I don't think unaffiliated is a party, but.
This is Elena. I just have another question going back to the secretary's comment about the canvas, and I'm just trying to understand how it would work. Because it seems like you could have a reconciliation problem if I check one box on the outside of the envelope but then vote something else on the inside. There's no way to reconcile that. So putting aside for a second just representation issues, but just from a election integrity perspective, having people select a preference on the front end helps you to have a more accurate canvas. So how would that work under if these initiatives were passed? How do you then go back and reconcile and make it all add up if there's no way to know what people were voting for? And how do we have confidence in that?
I think that's a good question. I think that's what we have to work through. That's what some of our concerns about having sending out the ballot that has all of the options on there, and then you have to choose a preference either on the envelope or on the ballot. I think that's a question we really have to delve into. And we've been thinking about it for a while now, and I'm not sure we have a good answer to that, because I can completely see how somebody would mark Republican and then vote the Democratic ballot. Like you said, like the secretary said, there's no way that we can go and cure that issue. So these are things we'd really have to think about, or just accept that there's going to be a certain error rate to our canvases, which I don't think is good, because I think it undermines the public trust in what we do.
So as a practical matter, there's an equipment problem as well, which is that we don't have equipment in the state of Colorado currently. And I don't speak to the Dominion equipment, the new equipment, because I'm not sure about that. But the equipment that already exists in counties and the majority of counties, I don't believe can be programmed to be able to count across the multiple sides of the ballot and reject ballots where one side has said a Republican and the other side has said a Democrat. So if the scenario in the state primary where you voted for one race here and then you voted, so a Democratic candidate on one race and a Republican candidate on another race, right now the equipment is not programmable to be able to reject that ballot. Maybe it can be retroactively programmed to do that, but I'm unaware of how that can be done. The Dominion system is much more sophisticated and maybe can be done that way. Right now I'm not sure that that's the case, but just practically speaking, it would be really difficult to count those ballots and to know when to reject something. So there's that practical problem that exists as well. Yes, Senator.
So if 140 passes, and I realize I was going down possibly an unnecessary tangent, but if 140 passes, it would be a ballot with just one race on it. But the legislature could move to combine so that we don't have two primary elections. We could move that, which I haven't really thought through. But just on its own, 140, we wouldn't have the crossover issue, because that would be a ballot with just one race on it.
I think you'd still have some crossover, because you would still have people that vote both races because they see two races on the ballot. And so they're going to vote the D race and vote the R race. I think you might also have a situation where if we had people put their preference on the outside of the envelope for the purpose of our canvas, then you would have somebody put R on the outside or not mark it at all and then vote the opposite on the inside. So you'd still have some spoilage issues.
But if they voted both ways in just that one race, then that would be an overvote.
Okay. Unfortunately, we don't have equipment that could catch that, because in its mind, so the equipment currently is the parameters of it are established by races, and so it would see the Republican alternatives on the left side of the ballot. Oh, let me reverse that. The Republican alternatives on the right side of the ballot, and it would not see those as competing with the Democratic alternatives on the left side of the ballot. So somebody selected one of the Republicans, it would say, fine, that's one race, they voted for one candidate. And then they would vote the one person on the left side of the ballot. The systems currently would see those as different races and perfectly reasonable votes and not as an overvote. So that's one problem with the equipment that we would have to overcome which I think with the old equipment is probably not something that can be overcome. Maybe with the new equipment, again, that's something that we haven't worked out yet.
And this is Suzanne. And in the initiative, it states that, you know, the combined ballot is where practicable. So I think that what we would see is some counties having to print two ballots because they don't have the ability to tabulate it. And then we would see some counties with a combined ballot. And so we would have some voter confusion there. We would also have some additional costs for the counties that can't tabulate it because now they would have to print multiple ballots. And then you'd have the problem where people return both.
This is Elena again. I just wanted to clarify, we've mostly been talking about presidential primary, but in terms of spoilage and crossover, those are the problems that would be created by 98, or are they addressed some way by the ballot measure? Or are they also up for legislative intervention?
Yeah, that problem would exist in both of the two initiatives. Can I also throw out one other just completely self-serving reason why there might need to be a revision? And that is that under the current writing of the initiative, the funding for the presidential primary is both very difficult on our office because it would create a second election that we would have to fund through the amount of money that we give back to the counties. Right now we give 80 and 90 cents to the counties per active voter for a general election. We would have to have additional funding for this presidential primary. But it would sort of undercut what the counties get anyway, because the counties are not going to get 80 and 90 cents for every active voter for that presidential primary. What they would get would be 80 and 90 cents for every person who actually voted. So you still have to produce the ballot. You still have to send the ballot. You have the mailing costs, the production costs, the paper and cardboard costs. All of those are sunk costs. And right now, under the current formula, we support that for the counties. Under this formula, we would not support that for anybody who didn't vote it. So the counties would be getting back far less than they do in the current general election scheme, and it would come twice in a year from our budget, which I'm pretty confident we can't support. So both of those two ends would need to be addressed, I think. One, we would need to get better funding for the counties. And then secondly, it would have to come from a different source, because coming from our office twice in a year would mean $3.5 million for the general and $3.5 million for the primary. We don't have $7 million sitting around that we can just hand out for two major events in 1 year. We can barely support the $3.5 million necessary to do the ones in the even year. So those are pretty serious problems in the current funding for the initiative. Yeah.
Just a quick point, too. So we've been talking about Dominion, about whether or not the new system can do this, and I'm not sure about the legacy systems. And from what we gather, the system as it is right now can't, but they think that one of the releases they have planned to come soon will be able to accommodate this type of voting. So from that standpoint, I think that's where we are on that.
Great. Good to know.
And this is Deborah Johnson. I think the question of funding is a major question, and I put the challenge to the legislators that are here that I think elections should be funded through the general fund.
And just to reiterate, the actual cost from our 2014 general election for all active voters was approximately $2.5 million. So if we were to duplicate that, it's going to be 2.5 for this general, and it would also be 2.5 for any presidential primary as well, if that language was changed.
So this is Pam Bacon. So since we're talking cost, it's interesting if any clerks did this, I did, you take what we cost out the primary that we just ran. And if you put these factors in on unaffiliated people not affiliating, and so your mail cost, your ballot cost, your envelope cost, your secrecy sleeve cost, all increase quite a bit, not knowing, you know, because we're going to have to mail them a ballot or two ballots depending on your system. And actually having those ballots printed and on hand, because like we do ballot on demand, but some of the smaller counties don't. So they incur a huge cost by having those additional ballots and not knowing when we're ordering. Because usually when you're ordering, you're like, okay, we have this many Republicans, we have this many Democrats, you know, add some on for people that affiliate. So it adds a huge cost to the factor of the unknown, and then also to have that possibility of those ballots being not necessarily voted so that they can be tabulated is discouraging, I think, on a clerk's perspective.
Any other questions or comments, thoughts on the presidential primary?
This is Peg Cage, and I would just like to comment that ballot access right now is very easy. We have 21 pairs of presidential candidate vice president and candidates on our ballot. Our ballot in Boulder is going to be 4 pages, 11 by 17, both sides. So ballot access is pretty easy. The cost, I believe, is what caused us to go back from the primary election to having the caucus election, or just taking out the primary election, presidential primary election. And the dates that are involved with all mail ballots, I think our legislators and our Secretary of State have a real challenge in front of them with these two ballot initiatives coming up. And if they could please keep in mind that it would serve the voters very well if you would get rid of the primary elections and the all-mail ballots. I think that that would help us to be able to have an election with integrity and focus the election back on the voters as opposed to the facilitators of the election.
So actually, Peg, you make a very good point. There's one other thing that I wanted to bring up, which is that under the initiative language, to be a candidate on the primary for the primary election, it would cost $500 to volunteer yourself as a candidate for one of the major parties. Currently, for this general election, it's $1,000 to get on as an unaffiliated, as just a candidate for president in Colorado. And we have 22 pairs, so we have 22 pairs of candidates for president and vice president right now. Plus, we have six people who are write-ins. But the 22 occupy a lot of space on the page, which is difficult for the counties. We might want to legislatively make it a little bit more challenging to get on the ballot. $500 to get on a presidential primary ballot is pretty inexpensive and may create a lot of unnecessary space used up on those ballots and frankly cause downstream difficulties. So that's one thing also to consider. Mr. Secretary, did you have anything that you wanted to add to this discussion?
I don't. I've got to take off here.
No problem. So I think what we'll do is we'll reconvene internally and maybe figure out where to go with this next, maybe write up what we've talked about, or maybe have a ongoing discussion on it. We'll get that together and get back to the commissioners. We do have an opportunity for very short, and I ask you to please keep it very short because we're supposed to be done here in the next 15 minutes or so. But we do have an opportunity for some very short public comment on the topics that you heard today. I have a list of people who have volunteered to come up and speak, and the first one on that list is Curtis Hubbard.
Thank you very much, and I will try to keep this short today. First off, thank you to all of you for taking time out of your schedules to pay attention to this important topic, which is the health of our democracy. And that's why we at Let Colorado Vote are running these ballot initiatives. I think there's one key point I want to make today, and that is that fundamental to the health of our state, to the health of our democracy, is participation in our democratic processes. And in Colorado right now, the largest group of voters, unaffiliated voters, cannot participate if they don't affiliate with one of the two major parties. That is at the core of our two initiatives. And I'll keep my remarks to the presidential primary since that was on the agenda for today. None of this discussion, which I think is worthwhile, and I would point out that we did run a statutory initiative, understanding that here in 2016, we may not foresee all of the issues that can or might come up with Colorado elections in the future. But none of the comments today were about participation. And that's what Colorado voters are most concerned with. Think back to March 1st. Democratic caucuses are overwhelmed. Republicans don't hold an official presidential preference primary in their caucuses, and a million unaffiliated voters are left on the sideline. Add it all up, 5% of active voters in Colorado had a say in the nomination contest for the presidential election this year. 5%, 1 in 20 Colorado voters. We can do better. And we believe Colorado voters will support that this November. Again, it was pointed out, the presidential primary measure does account for if there are issues with counties being able to process the ballots. They can issue multiple ballots. Ultimately, I want you to think about, this is 2016. We have plenty of time, if there are any unforeseen circumstances, to get those right before the 2020 presidential election. And our goal is to make sure that Coloradans have an opportunity to participate in that election. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to answer any questions as we go through this process. If you have them for us, we'll be happy to participate.
Any questions? Yes.
Thanks, Curtis. I have a question. I mean, under your initiative, it can remain just as it is now, correct? Because there's an opt-out for the parties.
That is correct. Parties could, if both initiatives pass, opt out of holding a primary that is open to unaffiliated voters.
Well, really, if either initiative passes, right? Both initiatives have an opt-out.
I need to double-check on whether 140 has the opt-out.
Okay.
Does it?
It has an opt-out, so it would remain as status quo if the
If the parties wanted to limit who could participate in the process and no longer use taxpayer money to conduct their party functions, then yes, they could opt out.
Okay. Which would be different than it is now and actually diminish participation.
Well, presumably it would be the same as it is now, the caucus that is closed to unaffiliated voters. And that's an important point, right? We have people here today who have a hard time finding 1 or 2 hours out of their workday to come and attend a meeting like this. Very similar to the caucus process, when people who might be a single mom or might work the night shift are unable to attend a Tuesday at 7 p.m., whereas a primary election takes place over several weeks and gives people the option to vote at their convenience.
Right, but in 98, which you brought up, that would actually diminish participation greatly if the parties opted out of the primary in 98, because right now...
That's a question for the parties. Our proposal is creating a system in which all voters would have an opportunity to participate in taxpayer-financed elections.
Well, to be fair, your proposal includes an opt-out.
Right, and that would be a step taken by the parties.
Thank you.
I think Representative Pabon had a question, and perhaps others.
Thank you, Judd. this is Dan Pabon. Curtis, what do you project as the percentage of participation from unaffiliated voters? You talk about a million voters, but
yeah. So we haven't done that calculation. What I can tell you is, and you all know this, Colorado has among the highest general election participation in the country, and that's a result of a lot of the steps that have been taken in recent years to increase participation. We think this is the next phase in that, in working to increase participation, and that voters treated just like Democrats and Republicans and being mailed a ballot rather than being forced to take additional steps will participate.
And the only reason I ask is because obviously we're spending a lot of time on the details of, you know, how broad or how much of an impact this is going to have on our clerks and our election system. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, of a million, are we talking about maybe 10% will participate or, you know, less than that?
Yeah. So to me, fundamentally, the question is not how many, but giving them the opportunity to participate. And right now, we are not giving them the opportunity to participate without forcing them to take steps that we don't require of Democrats and Republicans.
Do you plan to have any kind of projections anytime before the initiative?
I don't know that we would. I don't. I don't know that we could, with any confidence, do that. I can tell you, we've talked to unaffiliated voters across the state. And they tell us they want the option to participate. And I think fundamentally, on election day or the day after, we'll know whether or not they want to participate or not.
Thank you.
What step are we currently requiring them to take that we don't require Democrats or Republicans to take?
You're requiring them to affiliate with the party in order to receive a ballot and then to unaffiliate to return to their preferred status.
Aren't we requiring Republicans or Democrats to affiliate?
Republicans and Democrats get to keep their preferred status without having to take additional steps.
Curtis, do you worry at all that this creates an incentive to be unaffiliated? Because as a Democrat or a Republican, once I'm inside 29 days prior to the election, I can't switch from one party to another to vote in their primary. However, an unaffiliated could get both parties' nominees in one envelope and be able to pick at that moment which one they want to be. So as a party of an affiliated elector, you're disadvantaged in that you have less of a choice than an unaffiliated voter, and thus it sort of incentivizes being unaffiliated.
So what we worry about is under the existing system, 1 million voters are left out of the process. And even more importantly, voters are already leaving the parties in large numbers. And this is about the health of Colorado's democracy. Colorado leads the nation in the growth of unaffiliated voters since 2008. 50% of voters aged 25 and under are unaffiliated with either party. 47% of voters under age 40. Those are significant numbers. And if we don't get those people involved in the process, we really run the risk of damaging Colorado long term.
But just to follow up, are you worried at all that this would cause people to be more likely to become unaffiliated?
No, and actually several Republican and Democratic people who support our initiatives believe just the opposite, that it gives them a way to talk to voters about the importance of the party in selecting candidates and to say to them, you voted in our primary, now come talk to us about membership and we'll show you what being a member is all about.
But under the current language, the parties wouldn't know who those voters were. They wouldn't know which voters voted for Republicans and Democrats.
As somebody
they wouldn't
who works
know who
in
to
that
reach
space,
out.
The parties know quite a bit about voters already.
Okay, but they wouldn't know who which party a person had selected.
Not under our measure. That is correct.
Right. Okay. Were there other questions for Peg?
Curtis, this is Peg Cage, and I think that you've plugged in 1700 South Broadway, and we're at 1700 Broadway Street. So I think we were both trying to get here, but first of all, we don't have a democracy. We have a representative republic. And the way that you choose representatives is to meet with your neighbors and choose someone to go to the next assembly and the next assembly and the next assembly. And in this way, like a business, you would choose who you wanted to be your president in a closed board meeting. I think that we are trying to get to the same place, and the parties and the system have failed us because the parties don't stand for their platform, and it doesn't entice anyone to come and join us because they don't know what they're joining. So in order to be, to make a statement, they've unaffiliated. But the
primary is to choose the representative for each of the parties. And if you wanted to have another party with a different platform, that's a total possibility. I would like to work with you on trying to get the message that America is a representative republic, and we do need to choose the best people. And in the first place, we have a constitution that doesn't allow us to vote for our presidential candidate. We don't vote for president. We vote for the people who vote for the president. So this is all kind of a charade, having a presidential primary.
Could I ask one question really quickly, since you've been asking questions of me? How many unaffiliated voters are on this panel? So one, and just to point out to you, unaffiliated voters are the largest group of voters in Colorado at 36% of active voters.
Just a quick question on the, as I'm reading here, it looks like the date is designated by the governor on the initiative within a certain time frame. Is there any concern that a partisan governor might actually use RNC or DNC rules against a party they might not like? For instance, say RNC says that if you hold it before March 1st, and Colorado delegates will be cut in half for the RNC, but the DNC doesn't have that rule, so he purposely chooses a date before March 1st to kind of penalize the Republicans, and then they get less delegates, and we can't address the national rules. Is there any concern about that?
So I have faith in the fundamentals of our system, and I don't have that sort of a cynical attitude in terms of how politicians would behave. I think that Coloradans of all stripes believe that voting is important and that Colorado should have a say in the process, and a better say than we have in the existing process.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are really, really tight on time now. So I still have about six names on here. Does anybody on the list that wrote down their name still have issues that they want to cover that Curtis didn't mention? Would you like to come up? And tell us your name and organization you represent.
My name is Donna O'Cray-Harmon. I'm a grandma who just moved to Colorado last August from Michigan. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm here this morning, in we moved up to Gilpin County, and we love it. We love Colorado. But I feel like last August, we traveled 1,300 miles from Michigan, but back to 1820 because I didn't get a vote in a primary. I'm here this morning coming from Black Hawk because my husband and I went to the caucus. We never miss a vote. We vote in school elections. But we went to the caucus in Black Hawk, and we were there for 3 hours. And we kept waiting to vote and found out that there was not going to be a vote. We were new, so we didn't know about all of the shenanigans that happened with the Republican Party and getting angry because their vote didn't count at the National Convention in the last election. But what was really disgusting is that they asked us to, at the very end, we just raised our hands and said, well, why are we here then? Because I didn't understand. Why did we spend 3 hours? I could have been FaceTiming with my grandkids. And they said, well, yeah, you get to vote for the delegates. And I said, well, who are they going to vote for? You know, we couldn't even find out. There was no discussion of candidates at all in 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So we have a primary election in Michigan. And I really think that that's a better system. I just wrote a couple notes after listening to your conversation. One of them is that the costs, and I understand costs as a business owner, I understand that the money has to come from somewhere. It's not going to come out from a rock in the Rocky Mountains. But I do believe that my right to vote in a primary election to choose the candidate that I would like to see go forward in the presidential election, to use a common word right now, but it trumps
the cost that it takes to make this primary election happen. I really believe that. The cost of making that available to every voter registered in the state is worth whatever it takes, wherever the money is going to come from. I think the geniuses such as yourselves who are involved in the day-to-day effort to make this happen can come up with a way to make it work so that every voter in Colorado gets the chance to vote in a primary, and I hope you bring back the primary. Two more points. I disagree with the point about candidates paying their way onto a ballot, any amount of money, because really it's a representative government and people should have signatures signed by registered voters. If they have the support, then they should get on the ballot. So that would negate any problem with people who have a lot of money just saying, I want my name on that ballot. In Michigan, that's my old home. This is my new home. We're going to live here till we're dead. But I think one thing they do in Michigan that makes sense is they don't send out ballots to every single voter in every election. We go to the polls and we vote. If we're going to be on a vacation or we have work constrictions, we can't make it to the polls, then we can request a ballot be sent to us. And it's really worked for a long time, and I think it's pretty effective if you're talking about cost savings. My bottom line is, this grandma wants to vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, so that, why don't we leave it there? Thank you very much for those that, oh.
Very quickly, we have comments from other citizens who want to get committee to not stay for the entire duration. With respect for the committee's time, it would be all right to submit those comments.
That would be great, and we'll both post it on the internet, and then I'll make sure that each one of the commissioners get it as well. Great. The last thing we need to do on, not on the agenda, but that we need to do before we leave this meeting is schedule our next meeting. This is also your opportunity to tell us of any other topics you'd like to bring up. So you can either do that now in an open forum, or you can, email me separately and let me know about any other issues that you'd like to have come up in a future meeting. Peg?
So just real quick, this is Peg Cage. Before the election, I think we need to clarify the Secretary of State's ballot definition. Since we do have all mail ballots, there is no way to know how many ballots were actually cast. I think rather than having the definition be when the clerk receives it, could we please make the definition be the number of ballots cast is unknown. The number of ballots received by the county clerk and not rejected by the U.S. mail is equal to the number counted and not more than the electorate in each precinct. I think with that clarification, we will be able to certify elections, and without, we cannot.
We'll consider that.
Thank you.
Any other topics? Yes, Deb.
Deborah Johnson, one thing I'd like to consider, or at least put on everyone's radar, having to do with the constitutional language for putting judges on the ballot, and it's a space issue that we need to really consider.
Okay. This is Matt Crane again. I think... it would be really helpful if we could perhaps meet if there were time. I know there's not a lot going on between now and November, but if we could meet before the general election and perhaps have an overview of the integrity around the mail ballot process, how reports are run, how the counties handle data for that, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about that, and I think it'd be helpful if we could really get into that and clarify exactly what we do to protect the integrity around our elections.
Anybody not like that idea? I think I hear Clerk Crane volunteering to maybe we'll do a road trip down to Arapahoe County.
I would love that, and I know, Jennifer, you're listening, so you're welcome.
That was a reference to his election director, I believe. Elena.
This is Elena. I love the idea of a field trip, and I'm wondering if we can also add back in the discussion of work with the U.S. Postal Service. That was something that Matt brought up at the last meeting, and I think that would be helpful to this conversation as well.
Great. Representative?
Thanks. Yeah, and if we are going to discuss the petition signature verification, can you also give us like a quick brief overview of how your office handles that, the specifics? I think all of us have seen the signature verification that goes on in each clerk's office, but I don't think we've actually seen it through the Secretary of State and how that's handled. I think that would be helpful.
Absolutely, and we'll roll that into this if we, hypothetically, we can get this together, I assume. Do you, since you're going to be hosting, do you have a proposed date that you would
Let me take a look. Let me take a look. We'll have to do it before early voting starts because our facility is going to be used for early voting. So sometime before that, maybe the week before that, we can look to do that.
Okay.
Which, about a month from now.
So we'll be in touch. And I think what we'll probably have to do is throw out a date and a time, and whoever can make it can make it. It may be sort of less than the full group. And then at that meeting, we can set the next one. The next one will be post-election and maybe even into the new year, which might give us a little bit more flexibility. Less flexibility for some representatives, but more flexibility for some others. So we'll be in touch very soon about a date. And thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. And thanks to the audience for coming.
Sorry, that'd be great. Thanks.